Public schools are increasingly disciplining students for the trouble they get into away from school. It's raising the hackles of parents who say it's their job to discipline their children for problems that occur off campus. Now a New Jersey school district is being sued for punishing students who are caught drinking at weekend parties. Nancy Solomon reports.
In 2007, two Haddonfield students died from alcohol poisoning. Then, at one Wild House party, teenagers sprayed urine across the furniture and defecated in a piano. The affluent Philadelphia suburb reacted by creating an arrangement between the police and the schools. Any student arrested for drinking or drug use would be reported to the principal and disciplined there as well.
It's simply a vigilante system of justice established by a school board in violation of the Constitution of the United States.
Matthew Wolf is the attorney representing the parents of two 15-year-old girls who were arrested at separate parties in the last year. Their cases are still pending in juvenile court, but the school has already suspended the girls from their athletic teams and required them to do community service and undergo alcohol and drug counseling. Wolf says the off-campus policy violates the Constitution by duplicating the punishment and meeting it out before the kids have gone to court. Also, he says drinking at a party on Saturday night has nothing to do with school safety.
If a student has stabbed another student outside of the school or stabbed anyone outside the school, we don't contend that the school doesn't have the right to exercise its authority over students who commit serious offenses.
But the case is further complicated by the punishment. Haddonfield only suspends students from extracurricular activities, athletics, student government, school play. School board president Steve Weinstein says that's a far cry from violating constitutional rights.
This is not a criminal proceeding. We are talking about a code of conduct, which I want to emphasize, both students and their parents sign before they begin any extracurricular activity. And they've all agreed to it.
The code of conduct specifically prohibits students from consuming alcohol or drugs away from school. On a recent afternoon, I found Justin Janowski, a 10th grader, at a coffee shop in Haddonfield. He says he doesn't like the policy and thinks parents should be the ones making decisions about how to punish their kids outside of school. But he grudgingly admits the policy is effective.
I mean, when I was a wrestler and played football, like, that's one thing I didn't want to do is get kicked off the team for, like, bad grades or, like, I don't know, get caught smoking cigarettes outside of school. So I just didn't do it. I stayed good.
Janowski attends high school in a nearby district with the same policy. In the past decade, following the Columbine shooting, schools have suspended students for all sorts of misdeeds away from campus. Vandalism, minor drug possession, or cyberbullying. Courts have tended to uphold these policies as long as officials can show some connection to school safety. But beyond the legal issues, there's also rigorous debate about whether zero-tolerance policies are effective. Paul Hirschfield of Rutgers University studies and writes about the ways police and jails are increasingly used to deal with school behavior problems. He says suspensions tend to further alienate students rather than reconnect them to learning.
I see in these cases only an emphasis on suspending privileges, which is a form of punishment, rather than any emphasis on repairing any harms that the students have imposed on their schools.
Hirschfield prefers schools to take a more individual approach with discipline that encourages students to make amends and learn from their mistakes. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon.
After a House vote yesterday, businesses are a step closer to getting a tax break for hiring unemployed workers. The measure still needs final approval in the Senate. If it passes, businesses that hire unemployed workers will be exempt from the 6.2% Social Security payroll tax through December. They'll also get a $1,000 credit for every new worker they keep on the job for a year. Many in Congress doubt the bill will do much to create jobs. One worry is that most of the money will go to businesses that would have been hiring anyway. We thought we'd reach out to a couple of small business owners to find out what they were thinking. And first, we're going to Andy Hahn. He's general manager of Fountain Hills Door and Supply in Fountain Hills, Arizona. That's just outside Phoenix. He sells and installs doors and windows. Mr. Hahn, welcome to the program.
Hello, told Michelle.
I understand that you have 12 employees right now. If this bill passes, do you plan to hire any more?
No, we don't. At the current state, construction is at a standstill, and our business is closely related to the construction industry. We have to see growth in the industry before we add any more bodies into our system.
Help us understand just how hard the housing market has been hit there in Phoenix.
Specifically, I can tell you that our revenue numbers are roughly a third of where they were 2 years ago. Construction in the Phoenix area has virtually come to a standstill. The amount of inventory that is still on the market needs to be dissipated, and most of the banks and financial institutions are hesitant or just are not loaning any money to developers to start any new housing programs.
Is there anything the federal government could do that would convince you to hire new employees?
Yeah, the key thing that the federal government can do to convince us to hire is to get the construction industry going. In order for them to get the construction industry going, they have to really light the economy on fire, and they have to free up the financial institutions to be able to start loaning to people who want to start building houses.
Well, Mr. Hahn, all the best to you. Thank you very much for taking time to talk to us.
Certainly.
That's Andy Hahn. He's the general manager of Fountain Hills Door and Supply in Arizona. We go next to Simone Wilker in Paramus, New Jersey. She and her husband own Alpha Graphics, a printing and marketing shop. Ms. Wilker, you have 5 employees, is that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Are you planning on making any new hires?
Well, I would love to be able to hire a new salesperson because I think it would be great to increase our sales and our revenues. So that I definitely have in my mind.
I'll take that as a maybe.
I guess it depends on the financial ramifications of hiring someone new at this point in time.
Now, if you hired someone, you would potentially be exempt from the 6.2% Social Security payroll tax through the month of December. That make a difference at all to you?
Oh, yeah. That would be nice. I mean, every penny counts. That's the only way I can explain it. Every single penny counts. We're watching everything that we purchase, and we're watching our costs and paring everything down to the bone. And that's why I'm really considering hiring someone new, because if we could now increase our revenues and our sales, it would make a big difference to us.
Now, as you know, there's a debate here in Washington as to whether this bill would actually do enough to create jobs. You're the second small business owner we talked to. The first said he's not going to hire someone. You're saying, well, I might do it, but I'm not so sure. What would the government have to do to move you definitively and very quickly to, yes, I'm going to hire someone?
I guess it would be to increase the amount that they're willing to give you as an incentive. I mean, I would love to see $5,000 or $10,000. And I would say that having someone on the rolls as an unemployed individual is costing the government a bundle at this point in time. And so anything that could help them in hiring new people and getting them off the unemployment rolls would be an incentive for the government to offer me more money. So in my dreams, they'd be offering me $5,000 or $10,000 to hire someone. But I don't think that's realistic. So I would say that $1,000 plus not having to pay that Social Security tax for the month of December would certainly help. And if I'm already looking to hire somebody, that might be the turning point, whether I would hire them or not. And probably I would.
Well, good luck to you. Thank you very much for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That's Simone Wilker. She's the co-owner of Alpha Graphics in Paramus, New Jersey. Earlier, we heard from Andy Hahn of Fountain Hills Door and Supply in Arizona. We were talking to both of them about the tax break that businesses would receive for hiring unemployed workers should Congress pass President Obama's jobs bill.
Hollywood can be a place where people who call themselves environmental activists fly in for Earth Day on private planes from Aspen. But Susie Amis Cameron, who's married to director James Cameron, will also walk the walk along the red carpet at the Oscars. Susie Cameron will wear a garment that's described as an eco-dress, designed by Michigan State University senior Jillian Granz, who won an eco-dress design contest to raise money for an elementary school, which is described as eco-friendly. The dress is what Mr. Cameron calls Avatar Blue. Blue of the characters who are depicted in his Oscar-nominated film. According to the website EcoTerre, the dress is made from what's sometimes known as ahimsa, or peace silk, material spun from cocoons without killing the worms inside. EcoTerre describes the dress as zero waste, which is like Women's Wear Daily calling a new design stunning. The dress can be reworn and recycled, but if Susie Amis Cameron wears any Harry Winston jewels, she might not want to recycle them.
Up next, Yucca Mountain from a different point of view. When writer John Dagata moved his mother to the suburbs of Las Vegas, he began looking at the history of the government's plan to store nuclear waste deep in that Yucca Mountain. And the resulting book, About a Mountain, tells the story of Yucca and a suicide in Las Vegas, and in a way that that's parts reporter's notebook and part poetry. John Dagata is the author of About a Mountain. He's here with us. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks a lot.
It's you have wound a story of suicide and Yucca Mountain all together in a very interesting way that you have done it.
Yeah, well, I guess when I approached the subject of Yucca, I started thinking about the way perhaps since the 19th century we've wedded the idea of the scientific to progress, and how I think because of that, some of it's scientific catastrophes that I think have become some of our most potent metaphors.
Mm-hmm. Because we're running out of time, I'd like you to read a section of your book on page 85,
absolutely.
Which begins, "Beyond the trees, a haze of heat."
Sure. This is this takes place on a hiking trip I take with Edward Abbey's son and my mom, looking out on a mountain onto Yucca Mountain. Beyond the trees, a haze of heat listed over desert. 50 wavy miles, then highway strip, then miles, then black encrusted ridges bumping silently from earth. Mm. So, Josh said, "What do you think?" "Of what?" I asked. "Of Yucca," he said. "Where?" "Straight ahead." "Where?" "That low range." "Really?" I asked. Yucca Mountain isn't pretty, and it also isn't large. From far away, the mountain's just a squat bulge in the middle of the desert, essentially just debris from a bigger, stronger mountain that erupted millions of years ago and hurled its broken pieces into piles across the earth. The Shoshone say that Yucca is the carcass of a snake, a giant desert creature that was trying to find a drink, collapsed there in exhaustion, rotted as it died. "Better a cruel truth," Edward Abbey once wrote, "than a comfortable delusion." So we climbed the mountain higher, and the spruce began to wither, and the bristle cones to gather, and the pitch of trail sharpened, and the edge of ridge straightened, and the soil whisked off limestone sheets and loosened them to shingles. Joshua pulled my mother quickly in front of him and said, "Watch it here. The path is narrow," as the path ahead began to fade, and then it disappeared.
You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. That's a beautiful, beautiful passage that you read there. What did you learn about? You didn't set out to write a whole book about these two subjects together, did you?
No, not at all. But I guess as I started saying, I think because these scientific catastrophes are such well-worn metaphors in our culture, I felt I needed a way to re-electrify our vulnerability to the metaphor. And so so I wedded it to another metaphor, to the death of this boy in Las Vegas, a boy named Levi Presley, because I imagine that that was perhaps a more intimate kind of metaphor that we might be able to understand.
Mm-hmm. You thought that to connect with the readers, you couldn't just talk about Yucca Mountain, but create a weave in a character, a real person.
I think so. I mean, what's interesting for me about Yucca Mountain is that it is supposedly the most studied piece of geology on the planet at this point, and yet there's so much about it that we don't understand. I mean, I personally think it's the absolute worst place for nuclear waste storage, but there are still studies that were conducted looking at particular elements of the mountain that completely contradict each other. And so I'm kind of fascinated by this idea that we can surround ourselves with information. We can just pile up data after data after data and arm ourselves with facts, and yet still not be able to answer the questions that we have. And I think that suicide, not to simplify it, is the ultimate unknowable. And they seemed connected in that way.
Do you think we were in a state of denial about the mountain after we got all those facts?
I think we're in a state of denial still. I mean, that line by Edward Abbey, "A comfortable delusion," is ringing in my ears now. I mean, it was just a few weeks ago that President Obama pulled the funding for Yucca, just a few days ago that the Department of Energy decided to stop pursuing Yucca. But it was also just a week or so ago that the president announced the construction of a new nuclear power plant in the U.S. We seem to want the supposed benefits of nuclear power without having to deal with the waste. And it's... I think it's fairly irresponsible. I think it's actually pretty immature of us and typically American that we want something for nothing.
Oh, you've brought us full circle this hour because we started talking about nuclear power waste and about the president closing down Yucca Mountain. John DeGatta is the author of About a Mountain. Excellent read. Everybody who's read this will tell you the way he's weaved the story is fantastic. He's associate professor at the University of Iowa, where he teaches creative writing. I'm sorry we had an abbreviated talk with you today, but I want to thank you for taking time to be with us.
Okay. No, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Good luck to you. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Kim Mileski. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we have our video pick of the week. You can also find our video. Flora's got one up there about how you can make a guitar, electric guitar, for $10. Wow, how can you turn that one down? Also podcasting and Twittering. And you could also leave us some tweets at SciFry, at SCIFRI, and the folks are always there in Second Life and participating all week in our podcast. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Do you ever wonder where mountain ranges come from? How do they just appear? Well, last weekend's 8.8 magnitude earthquake rocked more than Chile's coastal cities. Geophysicists estimate that the quake pushed up the Andes Mountains, pushed them up a few feet more. It also shifted the Earth's axis by about 8 inches and shook up the planet's innards enough to change the speed of the Earth's rotation. Our days are about a microsecond shorter, according to one estimate. So if you feel tired, you can't get your work done, you know why. There's just not enough time left. Up next, we'll talk about this quake and how it upset the whole balance of the Earth and reshaped it. And since then, there have been numerous other tremors around the world. There have been earthquakes in different places out there. Are they all related? Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. That's at SCIFRI. And you can... take a look at the shape map. We have a shake map of the Chilean earthquake on our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guest. Ross Stein is a geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Glad to be here.
You're welcome. As I said, in the last week, there have been major earthquakes. We've had them in Japan and Chile, Taiwan, following the one in Haiti. Are these all related in any way?
We don't think so. Now, we could be wrong, and that happens, and I'm in a field where data trumps any kind of theory. But Our understanding is that while the entire Pacific Ring of Fire is subject to earthquakes, the event in Haiti has only affected the Caribbean neighborhood, and the Chilean event has only affected the Andes and the trench that's off that coast.
Give us a little geology lesson in the Andes there. What was going on in the Chilean earthquake?
Well, what we call the Nazca Plate, one of the dozen or so very thin pieces of the Earth's crust that are sliding around at speeds of a few inches a year, is jamming its way into and under the Andean Mountains. And so what's happening there is it is stuffing itself under the continent, and it does so in colossal earthquakes.
And it sort of pushes up. Every earthquake pushes up a little bit more of the mountain.
That's right. And so in this earthquake, we calculate that the coastline of Chile for 300-400 miles was uplifted several feet during this earthquake.
Mm-hmm. And what, does this shifting of mass around the world every time the Earth moves, does it make the Earth, we heard about it wobbling, is it that big an effect that it can actually affect the wobble of the Earth?
Well, what's happening is that the denser material, the plate, what we call the Nazca Plate, the oceanic material, which gets shoved underneath the continent because the continent is just a little less dense, you're basically jamming dense material deeper into the Earth. And just like a spinning skater that we watched during the Olympics, when she brings her arms in, she spins faster. So that's the same phenomena, that you're just moving the density of the Earth a little closer to the center.
Mm-hmm. And we're also experiencing a period where we're seeing other masses move. I'm thinking about melting glaciers, right? The forming pools of water, the ice is moving from one place to another. Could that also affect the Earth?
Yes, it can. I mean, obviously, that's not an earthquake-related phenomena, but as you melt glaciers, you obviously put more of the water into the ocean, and then you also remove the load and the land comes up, because essentially the crust of the Earth is just like a slab of rubber over silly putty. And when you remove the mass above it, it'll start springing back, first quickly and then slowly.
What does it mean that this earthquake shifted the Earth's figure, the axis, eight centimeters? And how does that happen?
Well, it's just because we are not at the equator. We're down in the mid-latitudes, the mid-southern latitudes. And so it causes the axis to shift slightly because we've changed the density structure of the Earth. In fact, it's very, very easy with a gravimeter to measure when you've moved up a few inches that you're farther from the center of the Earth.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this Chilean earthquake and the 1960 earthquake. Could they be related even though they're 40 or 50 years apart?
I think they're strongly related. First, the 1960 Chile earthquake is a magnitude 9.5. That's 20 times larger than the one we just had. And that's the largest earthquake ever recorded with seismic instruments. So it is a colossus compared to the earthquake that we had on the 27th. And we calculate that earthquake jacked up the stress at the site of the epicenter of this event by about a half a bar. That's about one-fifth or one-sixth of the pressure you put in car tires. And it seems to be enough, in general, to trigger seismicity.
And let's talk about the difference between a main shock, an aftershock, a foreshock. Are they all different phenomena or basically the same thing?
No, this is the sham of seismology. They're all the same, and we just use these words after the event. So if we have some little earthquakes and then we have a big one, in retrospect, we'll call those little earthquakes foreshocks. If we have a big one and we get little ones afterwards, which we always do, we'll call them aftershocks. But if I were to take, let's say, a magnitude 5 foreshock of a big main shock, and a magnitude 5 aftershock of a big main shock, and a magnitude 5 run-of-the-mill main shock, and I were to put them on a card table in Manhattan and ask someone as a kind of a card Monty to tell me which one is which, there's not a seismologist on Earth who could tell them apart.
Wow, the sham of geology.
So really, we don't know what marks a little earthquake for future greatness, and we don't know what really is a foreshock except looking backwards.
So give us an idea of perspective then. From a geology point of view, how do the Haiti and the Chile earthquakes compare in size and magnitude?
Okay, if we think of if we represent an earthquake's magnitude by or size by the volume of a sphere, then if imagine a ping pong ball. Mm-hmm. That's Haiti. Now imagine a big high school globe. That's Chile.
Wow.
So you could put 400 to 500 of those little ping pong balls inside the big high school globe. So there is an enormous difference in the size of these events.
And so why were so many people killed in Haiti but not in Chile?
Buildings. It's really staggering that when we try to remove the effect of the size of the earthquakes and just say, what percentage of people died who were subjected to severe shaking in both earthquakes? In Haiti, it was 8%. Mm-hmm. That not only means everybody knows somebody who died, everybody knows someone in their family who died. Now, compare that to Chile. The number, the percentage of people who died who were subjected to severe shaking was 0.01%. And what that means is the buildings in Haiti were hundreds of times, maybe 1,000 times less safe.
Wow. Wow. Let's talk about Charles Darwin, and I don't think people realize that he was actually around for another Chilean earthquake, right?
Not only another Chilean earthquake, but the earthquake that occurred right where this one was. So he was on the Beagle in 1835. They felt the earthquake, and he rowed ashore. And he got to shore, and the first thing he noticed is that it stunk. He wrote in his journal that it was putrefying. And he couldn't figure this out. Maybe it was gases. And then he began to see that all the marine intertidal life, all the little creatures there, were all dead. And that's why it stunk. And then he realized they were dead because these are creatures that get bathed by seawater twice a day, and they were all above sea level. So he said, okay, there's only two possibilities here. Either the water level has dropped or the land has risen. And he said, all the oceans are interconnected. There's no real way to drop the ocean. So he said, the land must have risen. And that's breathtaking all by itself, because at that time, nobody thought earthquakes involved permanent movement of the land. They thought they were just underground explosions. And so he saw that this earthquake jacked up the coast several feet during this event.
Wow. So he was like the father of modern geology in a certain sense.
It gets better.
Oh, I'm listening. Go ahead.
And then he did what only Darwin could do. He stood there on the beach, and he looked up at the 18,000-foot peak of the Andes, and he said, okay, that's how mountains are built. This mountain gets built by being jacked up several feet every several hundred years in earthquakes, and that's why Lord Byron plucked fossils out of limestone at the top of the Andes.
Wow.
And it gets better still.
There's more?
And then he goes, okay, at the rate this happens, the Earth must be extremely old. It must be millions of years old. It requires eons to build 20,000-foot mountains out of jacking them up 2 feet at a time every several hundred years.
And that didn't... There's more, I'll bet.
And so really, it's just a scandal that the biologists have absconded with Darwin's memory. He's ours. He's a geologist. And we're filing a class action suit.
I never heard this story before. Is this a well-known story among geologists?
It should be. And, yeah. You know, it points out something else, which is that what makes geology unique is that observation, look, is all he did is he smelled and he looked. Something like that is out there waiting for all of us. It's right in front of our nose. It doesn't necessarily take complex instruments. That ability to see what's right in front of you and make these connections is something that makes it special and is available to everyone.
And that's the genius of a lot of scientists. They can look at the simple things and synthesize something totally new out of it.
Yes.
Wow. Did he write much about this except that little observation?
He did write about it in The Voyage of the Beagle. And Captain Fitzroy also wrote about it, the captain of the ship. So and he did further investigations. He also saw that there were remains of Indian villages that had previously been at sea level and been jacked up by older earthquake. So he could see that when he looked back over kind of periods of 10,000 years or so, that what had once been right on the water was now 10 or 12 feet up. So he saw the continuity of these observations all pointing to the ability of mountains being built by successive earthquakes.
Wow.
So if you see a mountain, you're looking at past earthquakes.
That's a great thought to end our conversation. And thank you for that, Darwin. We're going to go read about the Beagle again and his recollection. Thank you, Russ.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah, you're welcome. Well, Russ Stern is a geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California. We're going to take a break. I'd like you to Google through Darwin there and see that what he wrote about the Beagle and the earthquake in Chile. Quite fascinating.